Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me is tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. By now well known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights, Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas. With all the discussion of increased droughts, forest fires, and enhanced hurricane season, tonight we discuss climate change.
Our guests tonight are engaged in the legal landscape surrounding climate change and environmental litigation, and provide us three very different perspectives, ranging from pro-business to environmentalism to academia.
As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. We'll pay the freight at 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guest cannot give you specific legal advice. We don't have all of the salient facts of your case. We're happy, however, to share the legal principles to help guide your decision-making. You can contact us with any question about the legal landscape of climate change or environmentalism. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation.
To help us sort out just what is going on out there, let me introduce our panelists. First, Shannon S. Broom is the managing partner of the San Francisco office of Hunton Andrews Kurth and leads the firm's California environmental practice. With prior experience as a chemical engineer in the oil and gas industry and maintaining an office in Washington, D.C., Ms. Broom has unparalleled insights into the development of regulations and counsel on environmental health and safety issues, and is well poised to help her clients wherever they may be with such matters as permitting, enforcement, environmental incident response, regulatory advocacy, and litigation.
Over the past 40 years, Phil Gregory has acted as lead counsel in a wide range of complex litigation, addressing high-profile environmental issues, business dealings, antitrust, financial fraud, intellectual property, trade secrets, and real estate. Prior to starting his own firm, Phil was a partner with the firm of Kachet, Petrie, and McCarthy. He's also been a partner with Ruppers Majeski, Cohn & Bentley, and with Hogue Fenton Jones & Appel, Inc.
Professor Dave Owen teaches courses in environmental, water, land use, energy, and administrative law at the University of California, Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. He's a graduate of Berkeley Law and a former federal court clerk and water lawyer. His research focuses primarily on water resource management and some recent projects that have addressed groundwater surface water interactions, the environmental consulting industry, taxation of water consumption, the roles of federal regional offices, stream protection under the Clean Water Act, and policies to expedite dam removals and hydropower upgrades.
One and all, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Dave, before we were on the air, you were talking about some interest-generating events that came out of recent news. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So if you've been watching the news, you may have heard about a group of teenagers who have been suing the Trump administration over climate change. You may also have seen stories about cities around the country suing the oil industry, bringing nuisance claims. And then, of course, we just got to the end of an election season in which we heard more about the environment and more specifically about climate change than we've ever heard in presidential politics before. So climate is very much in the news right now.
Before we go further, let me just add with respect to all of our panelists here that they're going to be expressing their individual views. They're not necessarily the views of their clients, their law firms, or their institutions. That said, in the next hour, you're going to hear about a slew of environmental issues ranging from climate change to mountaintop removal mining to the nationwide fracking boom. We have environmental laws state and federal that are addressing these, but some people consider them to be inadequate. And as a result, we have seen the increase in filing of what some would say are creative lawsuits to address these. And we're going to spend the next hour talking about these lawsuits. First off, these, every time I open the paper, they're talking about public trust lawsuits, and some are calling them atmospheric trust lawsuits. Can somebody explain what is the public trust and what are these public trust or atmospheric lawsuits and who's filing them?
Dave, this is Phil. Let me chime in here. Public trust lawsuits are based on a principle that the government is the trustee and its job is to protect what are called essential natural resources. What I mean by that is, let's call it the shoreline or the clean water, essential natural resources. And in this trustee role, the government is supposed to make sure that these essential natural resources are preserved for not only our youngest generation, but future generations. And these public trust principles not only go back to Justinian and the codes in Roman times, but they move all the way up through contemporary state constitutions. There's public trust principles in Oregon, in Rhode Island. And essentially what these cases now involve is that the government is not doing its job in protecting these essential natural resources. And primarily it's because the government itself is harming these natural resources. And those are the orientations of these cases.
I think we have a caller in queue.
We do, but let me ask you as a follow-up before we go further, what are the plaintiffs, who filed these and what do the plaintiffs hope to gain?
Well, essentially what the plaintiffs are children, they're youth, because they're the ones who are going to be most impacted by, you referred to atmospheric trust litigation. If our climate is significantly more damaged than it already is, it's not a geezer like me or my older generation that's going to be most harmed by a seriously damaged climate. It's youth and future generation. And so what they're filing these lawsuits for is to get the governments off their duff and to have them start not only preparing, but actually implementing plans that will hit specific science-based targets, targets that are set by scientists. And that it's the courts that need to impose these plans, because neither the state legislature nor the governor or the typical executive in a state will set up these plans and actually implement them.
We do have a caller in queue. Let me turn it over to Kolya from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, hi. This is somewhat related because I'm trying for a long time to start an international kind of a nonprofit education promotional organization. And I'll just say the acronym ITEM, to try to promote electric transport in all its forms, which is, of course, trying to fight the climate disaster the best we can. Getting rid of fossil fuel, and I'm not very expert in how to start a nonprofit. Maybe somebody could mention something on that.
If I understood you correctly, you're not an expert in the law of setting up a nonprofit?
Yes, and that's something I want to do, and I think it's very important.
Does anybody have a handle on that? It's a little off topic, but maybe you can help him if you have some familiarity.
Yeah, you want a corporate lawyer for that question. An environmental litigator is a somewhat different area of expertise.
Uh-huh. Corporate lawyer.
Somebody that can help you with
it. This is Shannon. I guess I just jump in and say it sounds like what you're hoping to do is to promote you know, deployment and market penetration of electric vehicles. And I would just say, as a citizen, there's a lot you can do without starting a nonprofit. You can participate in the California Air Resources Board. I've been participating just recently on a whole initiative they have to implement the governor's order to move to zero emission vehicles by 2035. And yeah, there are a slew of hearings.
Cars. This is also for railways, aircraft,
right? And absolutely. So last week, the California Air Resources Board issued its draft mobile source strategy for that issue, and it addresses light duty trucks and passenger vehicles, rail, other off-road, ocean-going vessels. There's a whole group of public processes where any citizen, you don't need to be a nonprofit, can participate in the process and have their voice heard.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. You know, before we go to the other materials we got out, I did get a question that was submitted by another caller who doesn't want to be on the air, talking about a video that she saw on Weatherbug for a funeral being held in Oregon for a glacier that melted. Have we started to evolve to a point, do you think, where we're actually treating some of these natural resources and phenomena as though they have some kind of personhood or some kind of an identity?
So I can speak to that one. In the United States legal system, the answer is generally no. People can advocate for natural resources or for a glacier, for a river, but the river itself doesn't have what we call standing, which is the ability to be a plaintiff bringing a case in court. There are other countries in the world, New Zealand, Colombia, where that sort of right has been accorded to a river, although, of course, always there's a human group that has to speak for it. So this is a legal innovation that has been tried in other parts of the world. But in the United States, the only analogous thing is a vote by the city of Toledo to grant legal personhood to Lake Erie that is entirely of symbolic value. We haven't really incorporated that concept into our legal system yet.
Well, Dave, let me add on to that. Corporations aren't people, but in instances, they have personhood. And so there are times where someone who doesn't have a heartbeat is deemed a person,
right, of
in
course,
the United States. Couldn't you analogize and make the same argument?
People do. I think that the standard response is that a corporation is chartered with particular interests in mind. So a corporation, whether it's the Sierra Club or a business corporation, has certain predefined interests that are set by people. Whereas, you know, if you give legal personhood to a river, the critique is that what that really means is that we're going to privilege a particular group of people to tell us what the river wants, when really what they're going to do is tell us what they want. And so the argument is that that's a little bit different from corporate personhood. Whether you buy that argument or not is another question.
You know, it may be a different question, but a related one. It seems that what people are trying to do with some of these claims, putting names and claiming that whether it's a rock or a river, whatever, that they have, that they're individuals, what they're really trying to do is establish certain rights, not for those items themselves, but for all of us collectively on the planet. With that in mind, do you think the governments of the world have a legal duty to protect the atmosphere?
Well, let's talk about that question in terms of, does the government have a duty not to harm its citizens? Because if you frame it in the terms of protecting the atmosphere, I think in and of itself, it's no. But what if the government is engaging in conduct that, through poisoning the air or contaminating the water, it's harming the citizens? In that respect, the government clearly has a duty not to harm its citizens. I don't want to belong to a country where the government is harming me. In fact, that was the whole point behind the Declaration of Independence. So if you frame it as, do you have a duty not to harm something that is, to go back to my term, an essential natural resource, then I think the answer is very clear. The government does have a duty not to harm.
Do you think, taking it a step further, do you think that we have a constitutional right to a reasonably clean environment?
Well, in the Giuliani case, quickly, Judge Ann Aiken was very clear in her November 2016 decision that if readers want to review it, it's at the website for Our OUR Children's Trust. And on November 10, 2016, Judge Aiken said that she had no doubt that the right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life is fundamental to a free and ordered society, when the claim is that the governmental action is damaging the climate. Otherwise, then the Constitution affords us no protection. And I think Judge Aiken was absolutely right.
Can I just jump in there? I mean, I do want to point out that, as Dave was mentioning earlier, that these cases are currently being litigated against the Trump administration. But of course, they were initiated against the Obama administration. That's when they started. And the Obama Department of Justice argued that there was no constitutional right to a pollution-free environment. And I'm quoting language when I say that, and that the court system was not the proper venue to effect such changes. There simply is no constitutional right to a pollution-free environment. The federal courts are not a proper forum. That's what they said. And then eventually this has all come up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, who decided the case on other grounds and said that the courts are not even if there is a constitutional right, the courts are not the proper place to fashion a remedy. That is for the legislature to do that. And right now, I believe that that case is pending petition for rehearing. Is that right, Dave?
I think it's en banc rehearing that they've petitioned for.
They're waiting, and we haven't heard back from the Ninth Circuit on that. I'm not directly involved in that case, but Dave, did you want to jump in? I didn't mean to step
in
here.
I was just going to say also that, you know, there's two questions. There's what do we think, and then there's what is the likely view of at least five justices on the United States Supreme Court. And I think it is all but certain that if the Giuliani case makes it to the United States Supreme Court as it is currently composed, that the court will hold that there is not a constitutional right to a healthy environment. This is a court that is very, very conservative. It was largely handpicked by the Heritage Foundation, which is a climate denial organization, in anticipation of cases like this one. And so the likelihood that the Supreme Court will agree with the Giuliani plaintiffs, I think, is very nearly non-existent.
And Dave, this is Phil. I just want to point out, and I understand that view. That's the same view the attorneys had in Brown versus Board of Education. Don't go to the Supreme Court with this case. That's the same view, as you know, they had in Massachusetts versus EPA. Go to the Supreme Court with this case. That's the same they had with gay marriage. Don't go to the Supreme Court with this case. You won't stand a chance. And in each of those cases, the fundamental right prevailed, because what it involved is the government harming U.S. citizens. And that's what you have.
I just sent him a text on exactly that.
The evidence is uncontested. The government is harming these children. And the Ninth Circuit found it, and the district court found it. So I really think on the record before would go before the Supreme Court, or the record that's currently before the Ninth Circuit, what's going on here is climate change is being caused in large part by the United States government. The United States government is not addressing the harms being done by climate change, and you've got a great evidentiary record, the best record we're going to have to go up to the Supreme Court.
And I would just say, if I were the judge you were arguing it before, I think you might have a sympathetic audience, but I'm not. You're going to argue this case before an exceeding, if you get it. I think the court would be intrigued enough that it might grant a cert petition. At a minimum, to win that case, you have to persuade Justice Roberts to reverse his own position from Massachusetts versus EPA, an earlier case where he said that climate litigants shouldn't have standing to even get into court. And you're going to have to win over one other justice who is either Clarence Thomas or was specifically vetted and chosen by the Heritage Foundation, which basically handled Donald Trump's judicial nominations. And there is no more there's no stronger climate denial organization in this country. So it's effectively the equivalent of handing your opponent, you know, a loaded gun and saying, I'm going to sweet talk you out of shooting me.
So you've been talking about one particular lawsuit that you said is at the Ninth Circuit, but there are many of these lawsuits throughout the states. Where generally do they stand? Have plaintiffs been successful in any of these?
In the atmospheric trust litigation cases in the United States so far, no. Plaintiffs have successfully survived some motions to dismiss. Let me qualify that. Part of what the plaintiffs in these cases are trying to do is just raise awareness. And they have been spectacularly successful at that. They've gotten a lot of media attention to the basic sympathy and justice of their cause. But in terms of producing legal victories that lead to orders to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, they have not been successful.
Are you saying it was a show?
A good show. Will disagree with me on this.
I don't think that's fair. I mean, I think what it is it's advocacy. And so we're lawyers and we do advocacy, and I practice law. I do some litigation. I also practice before an agency, and if I have a goal I'm trying to achieve, I look at venues that I can advance my cause. And if one of they might have been successful. I mean, look at all the litigation that's surrounded, that people have differing opinions. I think it's pretty clear that they, have this issue that the Ninth Circuit judges pointed out, at least on remedy, but you know, it's not frivolous for them to at least raise the question, and they're trying to raise awareness. So I don't think that somebody was doing a Rule 11 violation or something like that.
I didn't mean to imply that at all.
No, I know you didn't, but it's the notion that in advocacy, you look at as many venues as you can and you decide what's effective. I might disagree with their judgment in having brought those, but I can see what they were thinking.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're discussing the legal landscape surrounding climate change. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're calling outside the local area, toll free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to the laws surrounding climate change, or even just call to talk about environmental activism. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. So what are the climate nuisance cases all about?
Okay, I'll start with that and let others jump in. So these cases originated actually here in California, like so many environmental issues seem to find their way emerging from California. And they sound in public and private nuisance and trespass is how they started. And they are brought by cities and counties and some states at this point now against fossil fuel companies, claiming that by the sale of their product, and they're kind of modeled on the tobacco litigation of a couple of decades ago, where they're saying that by marketing this product And having that burned in cars that cause climate change. And so these companies should be responsible for the cost that the cities and counties have and states have incurred in combating the effects of climate change. And they started here in California, and they've gone now spread to the East Coast, to Charleston, South Carolina, Rhode Island, Baltimore. We just had two cases that were filed in Hawaii. There's one going in Colorado. So they're really just spreading across the country.
Now, there are similar lawsuits, I believe, maybe same type of model, going after entities, businesses that have allegedly contaminated water supply, that local governments, state governments are going after them. Is that the same theory?
It's slightly different, but along those lines. In fact, you know what's interesting is that the cases, as they've been filed across the country, have morphed a little bit, and they've added claims of false advertising, basically, type of claims, invoking consumer protection statutes under state law. And what's interesting about that is that they are adding on more and more types of claims depending on what jurisdiction they are in. But in large part, they are all being promoted by one or two law firms that kind of started this whole thing and went around and started seeking cities and counties to sign up with them for these lawsuits and to bring them against the oil and gas industry, and I think one or two coal companies as well.
So how are they different from – oh, I'm sorry. Phil, let me just
get – Josh, one point I think you your listeners would be very interested in is Shannon alluded to the lead paint cases, and the lead paint cases were brought and tried in Santa Clara County before then-Judge Kleinberg. And the county council's office, my former firm, Kachet, Petrie, and McCarthy, tried those the lead paint cases, and they were resulted in a $1 billion verdict and resulted in the judgment being upheld on appeal in the Court of Appeals. And the point there, these cases in other areas, whether it's lead paint, it's recently the opioids, they're very successful against the manufacturers once they get to trial. The issue is, as we all know, the courts great job delaying cases going to trial.
Or stop them from going to trial. Why are these cases unique?
So I'll chime in with one important difference, which is that the generation of climate nuisance cases that we're seeing now are all brought under state law. And if right now there's a question about whether these cases are removable to federal court, that's going to go before the United States Supreme Court. But if the plaintiffs are successful in keeping these cases in state court, that and ensuring that they're decided under state law, that means that the last word on these cases is going to come from state Supreme Courts rather than the United States Supreme Court, which potentially avoids the issue with a very conservative Supreme Court that you have with the Giuliana litigation.
And you start somewhere and start building up credibility. When that starts working in other states, maybe at some point there'll be a critical mass. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco, and we'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're back with Your Legal Rights. I'd be remiss if I didn't at some point during the hour briefly take a moment to tell you about some of the more interesting shows we have coming up. Why, next week we have a serious look at what cases are in queue to come up before the U.S. Supreme Court. You want to know the things that they will be deciding in the next 5-6 months, exactly where they're coming from? That's next week's show with some very interesting guests. Josh, what's after that?
Boy, I don't know the exact order. You threw me on that one. I know we have ones coming up dealing with trust and estate issues, common real property issues. After the Supreme Court, we are doing one on artificial intelligence. I believe we have bankruptcy and student loans.
And after artificial intelligence, we have one coming up to give you your year-end tax tips. We're awfully close to the end of the year. You need to know what you can do to stem some of the bleeding. And that's coming up on December 23rd. On December 30th, we're going to be taking a step back and taking a look at what might be the last salvo of the campaign to reelect the president. It's assumed by the media that these lawsuits are going nowhere. My guest coming up on December 30th. My guest coming up December 30 would suggest the lawsuits are but a diversion. The real move is coming at the first part of January. It'll be a very interesting show. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden, and tonight I'm joined with co-host Josh Borger. We're talking about the legal landscape surrounding climate change. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're not calling from inside the Bay Area, let us pay the freight. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to the law surrounding climate change or anything you want to share with us about environmental activism. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation.
Let me jump in. There was an interesting lawsuit that was filed in February of this year. Earth Island Institute sued Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Nestle, Clorox, and among others, claiming they've been polluting the world's oceans with millions of tons of plastic. Perhaps somebody's familiar and they could talk about that case, where that is right now, and how that compares with the other types of lawsuits that we've been discussing. It seems very similar.
Well, I'll jump in. And I know we were going to have a guest who was pretty active in those who wasn't able to make it. So those cases are doing the same type of thing as the cases that we were just talking about in the climate nuisance cases, and they are basically saying that the degradation, it's these microplastics, the degradation of the plastic that we all use, you know, in our water bottles or whatever, when it goes down, it breaks down and it is impacting the world's oceans and the ecosystems. And the theory is that by marketing these products, that these companies have caused a public nuisance. And I think that those cases are slightly different than the climate nuisance cases, although I haven't studied them as in depth. But they, in that they're not public entities bringing the lawsuit that have incurred damage. They're more like citizen suits. And so I think they're going to have a tougher time on some of the standing concerns and other kind of procedural hurdles to get into court. And, you know, just before we went to break, we were talking about the Supreme Court case that is up. And I just want to make sure people understand that, you know, you'll hear, oh my gosh, there's this climate nuisance case at the Supreme Court, but not really, because what's before the Supreme Court right now is this very procedural issue about whether the courts of appeal can hear the question of whether the cases belong in federal court based on the federal common law ground. And so the nuisance cases, the theory of the case is that state common law applies and you create a public nuisance. The defendants have argued that no, state common law can't apply here. It's displaced, and only federal common law can apply. And then eventually there will be an argument that if federal common law applies, there's no remedy because it's not justiciable. But the question is this a federal question you can get into federal court? And one of the claims that that the defendants have said gives it a basis for federal court is this thing called the Federal Officer Removal Statute, which goes back to like 1789. And the whole theory of that statute was to prevent federal officers from being hauled into state court and the prejudice that could happen to federal officers and people acting under the direction of federal officers, which the oil and gas companies were in producing this oil for wartime. Remember, Congressman O'Mahony testified in World War II, I think, that the oil industry was the single greatest weapon to effectuate the victory. And so that is the theory of why the cases belong in federal court. And that's what the Supreme Court is looking at now. And they're looking at whether when you bring a federal officer claim that's the basis for federal court, you could also decide at the appellate level whether that federal common law claim also gives you jurisdiction in federal court. Otherwise, as was being said earlier, I think Dave was saying, you go back to state court and you appeal all the way up through the state Supreme Court. So it sounds very procedural, but it's a really important issue that is going to dictate kind of how soon these cases get resolved, I think.
Let's take a step back, though. For the non-lawyers, when we talk about removal or jurisdiction, we're really talking about which court hears the case. But I guess a broader question we should probably start with is, why are people turning to the courts to resolve environmental issues like climate change? Is this the best place to address these things?
Well, the core issue here is if the judiciary is being presented with this case, it's because the president and the executive branch, as well as Congress, is not addressing these core issues. The Earth Island plastic case, the federal government is not addressing the whole plastics issue. The administration did everything it could to put its foot on the fossil fuel accelerator. And I want to make a point that to go back to something Shannon appropriately said, the 21 youth in Juliana sued the Obama administration. And a lot of people view Obama as the climate president who looked out for the most for our climate. Well, even Obama says that during his administration, more fossil fuels came out of federal lands than any prior administration. So if you look at the chart, if your listeners can imagine a chart where the numbers are either going and the lines are either going up or they're going down, in Obama, they went drastically up in terms of parts per million in the
Gregory's not the title name.
And the reason is none of the other branches are addressing the climate in children have no recourse. They can't vote for the president if you're 13 years old. You can't get a vote for a member of Congress if you're 15 years old. So the only remedy you have is the courts, and the courts have fundamentally neglected the rights of children in these cases.
So I'm gonna disagree with parts of that. First off, I think it's important to understand that part of the reason that we talk about climate change court cases so much in these particular court cases is that they've captured the imagination of the media. But there are hundreds of climate change related court cases going on right now with a wide variety, or in the past several years, with a wide variety of different theories. So this is just the tip of the iceberg of what goes on in courts. And then what goes on in courts is just the tip of the iceberg for climate law as a whole. There is legislation, both at federal and state levels, that deals with climate change. It's not cap and trade. It's not an economy-wide carbon tax at the federal level. But legislation dealing with renewable energy, legislation like the Clean Air Act that has provided a platform for regulating the electricity sector, for regulating mobile source emissions. There's a lot of different ways in which other sources of law do have something to say about climate. Now, where I will strongly agree with Phil is that we're way off the pace, that these other sources of law, particularly at the federal level and even in state levels, at states that have been very progressive like California, are not accomplishing things nearly fast enough. But with that said, I think part of the reason, you know, we've spent 40 minutes talking about climate nuisance cases in Juliana is that it's a compelling story. But it's a really small piece of a much bigger picture.
I want to agree with Dave on that. You know, a lot of my day-to-day is working on climate regulation and what's going on at the federal and state levels. And there's a lot going on, but I think that it was frustration that things were not moving fast enough. And now I think there was a great opportunity with the Waxman-Markey bill, which was a climate cap and trade bill that was in play at the beginning of the Obama administration. And the regulated industries were at the table and participating, and there was a move, you know, legislation's complicated, but I would say that the ENGOs, you know, pulled away from the table. They decided it was a strategic move. They knew they had the White House. They said, you know, we had President Obama. He said, I have a phone and I have a pen. And he progressed, and they made a lot of progress, right? They did the Clean Power Plan. They have issued, there were methane regulations on the oil and gas industry. There were, you know, there was the renewable fuel standard implementation. All of those are an extensive amount of climate regulation that has occurred. And I think, again, as Dave says, it was really the pace, I think, that was causing the frustration. And Congress hasn't passed a law. So,
you know, you both brought up what to me seems to be the really the crux of this thing. We've been talking about all these cases building up and challenges to the administration. And we've just had an election, and it looks like that administration is changing. And with that, it begs the question, how do you see the change in administration impacting some of these cases that are in the works, particularly the nuisance and constitution and public trust cases? Do you think that government action may make some of the plaintiffs think about withdrawing those cases and trying to work the government again, perhaps a more friendly form?
Well, is the Biden administration, in terms of the Juliana case and the other cases we've been talking about against the federal government, they're going to become the new defendants in these cases. And instead of fighting on these issues, for example, instead of it fighting the youth in Juliana, the Biden-Harris administration could down and determine whether or not they're going to use the Constitution to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity, as it says in the preamble to the Constitution, and work with youth to come up with a sensible resolution based on the science and based on the economics to address the climate crisis.
So I'll just say quickly, I don't think you're going to see any change in the nuisance cases, because those are against oil companies, not against the Biden administration. With Giuliani, I think probably you're going to see a fairly similar position from the Biden administration that you saw from the Obama administration, which is going to be to say, we are going to try to do things on climate, but this case isn't the way to get it done. And so you will likely see the immediately, I think you're going to see strong opposition to any sort of petition for review at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I guess one principle I see, regardless of what administration is in power, is that they like to maximize their discretion. And the idea that, you know, the remedy sought in Giuliani is that the court would supervise a federal plan to, you know, cease all permitting, authorizing, and subsidizing of fossil fuel. Basically, the court would get its fingers in everything that the executive branch does is effective with respect to this particular topic. And I think that no administration is going to be a fan of that. I could be wrong, but
so the ultimate question I want to leave with is, tell us what you think is ahead generally in terms of climate law, where it's going to come from, how it's going to get there. What changes are we looking at?
Who wants to go first?
I think everybody has views of this, but nobody wants to step on each other.
I'll lead, and I will tell an optimistic story of what I think could happen, although it is going to start out sounding pessimistic. I think for a long time in the climate law realm, we've been hoping for the big solution. So that could be a nationwide cap and trade program, a nationwide aggressive climate bill, or a win in a case like Giuliani that leads to orders that make major changes. And the reality is we're not getting it. The politics are impossible right now in D.C. for that sort of bill. And as I've already said, I don't think the Giuliani plaintiffs can win in the current courts. But on the other hand, I think one thing that we've seen in states like California in particular is a positive feedback loop where if you have some form of climate regulation, whether it's through renewable portfolio standards or subsidies for electric vehicles, whatever it is, it spurs the development of new technology, which then creates both interest group support for continued climate regulation, but also just creates a sense that these new technologies are exciting. They're cool. I mean, get behind the wheel of an electric car and you will feel better about our climate future. And so those sorts of feedback loops suggest to me that even incremental improvements in climate regulation, even if they're not comprehensive solutions, can take on their own momentum. And then the hard question is whether they can do it fast enough. And there, obviously, we don't know, but we're not on a good enough trajectory yet.
I guess I'll jump in. I agree with Dave on the climate nuisance suits continuing. But when I think about what's happening, the market forces are driving change on climate. And I think that as a society, we do the best when we harness the market forces to achieve what is otherwise a lofty goal. And you're going to see more and more of that. And as I think, Dave, you're referring to some of these economic incentives, we will see states take more and more of a lead on zero emission vehicles and looking at, you know, obviously, immediate change at the federal level on trying to bring back some of the clean power plant things, the methane regulation, all of the things that were rethought in the last administration. And they may not come back all the way, but they may come back smarter and better because there were potential legal flaws in a lot of the construct that was used there, and maybe those can be shored up and they'll come to actually even a better solution. But I see action happening at the federal level, and that the state action will continue and spread.
I first want to start with something Dave said a while back ago, and this was about the public trust cases. Many of the public trust cases that were filed years ago resulted in states changing their regulations, addressing fracking, addressing oil and gas development. These cases that were filed in Massachusetts and Colorado and the state of Washington all resulted in fundamental state governmental change. What is very worrisome, and I think we would all agree with that, is that the science, whether it's the federal government scientists, it's the UN scientists, all agree that the targets in the Paris Agreement, the 1.5 or the 2.0, are extraordinarily problematic because they were set by politicians, not by scientists. And we all saw what happened in the COVID situation when the current administration tried to put aside what the, what I'm going to call experts, were telling the administration should happen. And what is extraordinarily troublesome to me and to a number of people is that politicians lead from behind. And they can't make the tough decisions that need to be made in this crisis. And essentially what's going to need to take place is, as Kurt Vonnegut once said, the excrement's going to need to hit the air conditioning. And then at that point, something will be done. But my fear is to now end on a pessimistic note that Congress and the president will be too late, and it's really up to the courts, it's really up to the climate advocates to step in and do something.
So let me add, and it sounds like, Phil, you might have just answered this, that President-elect Biden has promised to rejoin the Paris Agreement, which is, for those listening, an international climate treaty, but you're suggesting that that actually isn't going to make any difference whatsoever.
Well, there's a report prepared by the IPCC, an international body, of what happens if we hit the target of 1.5 degrees. So the Paris Agreement said the worst situation is 2.0, but a bad situation is 1.5. And you hear these politicians all talking about, well, letting our atmosphere heat up to a 1.5 centigrade level. And the problem with that, obviously, is that's a politically defined goal. The climate scientists, to a person, all say that is just going to be a complete disaster. We're going to have worse droughts than we're experiencing in the Southwest, worse hurricanes than we're experiencing in the Florida area, worse wildfires than we're experiencing in California, Colorado, and Oregon. So I'm again worried that Paris is being seen as a rainbow, that if we can just get to the end of it, we're going to have a pot of gold, and that simply ain't the case.
We're essentially out of time for our questions, and I wanted to give each of you a couple minutes for any closing thoughts, anything you want to say at the end. Shannon, you want to go first?
Sure. I guess I'm more optimistic than Phil is. I see a lot of amazing things happening on the regulatory front, and I think that we should be putting our energy into regulation, and it would be great if Congress would engage meaningfully and do legislation. We'll see how the Senate comes out. I guess we're still waiting for the results there as to whether they can come to the table on all of that. But regardless of whether there is legislation, we are seeing so much positive movement, just even from companies. You know, the utilities want to be the new fuel, right? They're the EV fuel. And so you're going to see a lot of motivation from the private sector doing some really amazing things over the next decade. And this, the new California plan is really interesting with folks moving forward with battery electric equipment at a wide level. And so I'm very bullish on that. And I do think that these cases are, they'll wind their way through and eventually we'll get substantive decisions. But for now, I think Dave's point that they haven't been successful is a sign that what we should be doing is working on real regulation and legislation if this is what we want to do, and do it in a structured, efficient way.
Professor, would you like to join in? 2 to 3 minutes.
2 to 3 minutes. Okay, a couple points. One is, I think it's important to keep in mind whenever we're talking about climate and the targets we're trying to achieve, that increments do matter. That even, you know, that we are at this point facing a choice between bad outcomes and significantly worse outcomes. We're not going to avoid climate change. It's already occurring. But the degree matters. And so even changes that are not complete solutions can be very, very important to our future. Another point, just sort of related to that, that I think is important for us to think about, because we're here in California, is the role of states and the role of smaller jurisdictions. And you might, you know, think this is a global problem. What can states do? How important is what we do here in California? But a different way of thinking about it is that even the United States as a whole at this point is less than 20% of global emissions now. If you look at our historic share, it's going to be a little bit larger. But of present day emissions, we've got a relatively small share. So even if the United States gets its act fully in order, that's not enough. And the lesson that I think that I can take from that, and that I think that California policymakers have taken from that, is that it's important to think about policies that can be replicable, that can be imitated elsewhere, and that spur technology that will travel elsewhere. And on that front, I think those of us who live here in California can feel like we're actually, our state's doing a really good job at testing out innovations. And a friend who once said, nobody wants to be preached at by Californians, but if we do something and it works, people will follow us. And so some of the innovations we are making here with trying to create a better climate for electric vehicles, working with a grid that is increasingly dominated by renewables, trying to push forward energy storage. There are a variety of different ways in which we're innovating here and trying to export those innovations around the world. And that's going to be key to the degree of success that any effort through law to respond to climate change, the degree of success it achieves.
And I'm sorry, Josh, Phil, I wish I could give you a couple more minutes, but we're essentially out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been talking the legal landscape surrounding climate change. Our guests tonight have been Professor Dave Owen from the University of California Hastings College of Law in San Francisco, Phil Gregory, an attorney with some 40 years' experience in environmental litigation, and Shannon Broom, managing partner of the San Francisco office of Hunt and Andrews Kurth, who leads the firm's California environmental practice. Our show tonight has been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Your Legal Rights returns next week at our new time of 6 o'clock to discuss what's in the hopper, cases now pending before the United States Supreme Court. Once again, our thanks. Thank you to Phil Gregory, Shannon Broom, and Dr. Dave Owen, and to my co-host tonight, Dave Borger, and especially our thanks to all of you for joining us and for listening tonight. And at the controls, Debbie Kennedy, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.